Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
So welcome to a chili-themed episode of The Science of Sports with myself, Mike Finch. And as usual, I'm here with Professor Ross Tucker. But we have a few guests which we're going to be introducing throughout the day today, well, throughout the podcast today, and focus very much on the physiology of a sport that's of sports that we don't really talk about very often here on our podcast, and that is the winter sports of cross-country skiing. And we talked about alpine skiing. We talked about, first up, we're going to be talking about ice hockey. Let's just run through. We're not going to talk about all the winter sports because there are literally hundreds of them out there. But we decided to talk first of all to a specialist in the ice hockey space. Tell us about why we chose Tommy.
Well, partly convenience because I know Tommy.
It always helps.
Yes, and I was doing an interview with him the other day. Tommy is a lecturer and a researcher at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, which is one of the great academic institutes for, including many things, but sports science. And he also works as a consultant for Swedish ice hockey. And that came up in conversation. And I said to him, hey, why don't we talk about ice hockey? And he said, it's a fascinating sport because ice hockey is a sprint activity buried in an endurance event. Yeah. Because they are, and you'll hear this from Tommy, you're on the ice for 30 to 60 seconds and then you get a couple of minutes. Then you do it again and again and again for an hour. And so there's some really interesting physiology there, and I thought it'd be interesting to ask him to talk about that. Because, as you say, I saw snow for the first time when I was 25, and I've skied once in my life, and it didn't go well. But I love the Winter Olympics. I'm absolutely fascinated by them. It's honestly the best 10 days I have every couple of years, because there's a novelty fascination and a technical fascination with these sports. They are so interesting to me, and so I said, Tommy, I'm going to get you on and we're going to pick your brain. And that's what we did for ice hockey.
Well, here is Tommy Lindberg. Well, Tommy, welcome to the Science of Sport podcast. For us here in South Africa, there is obviously not a lot of talk about winter sports and probably even a little talk about ice hockey in particular. So we thought we'd bring you on to kind of explain to us, you know, I think we all watched it on television and have seen highlights of hockey, ice hockey matches around the world, no matter where you've been, particularly of ice hockey fights, which seem to be a speciality. Can you just sort of talk to us very briefly about the sort of physiological challenges that ice hockey players are faced with?
Yeah, sure. So it's quite a special sport, I think, and an interesting sport from a physiological perspective. I mean, there are certainly a lot of scientific studies on ice hockey as well, and it's growing in recent years. But I guess if you compare it with other sports, you know, like football, soccer, etc., it's relatively little research still, you could say. But the game itself is relatively well described in the literature. It's quite anaerobic, which is quite special. Obviously, I mean, the basis of it, that you're on skates on a rink, that's, you know, special in itself. But it's very intensity. Intermittent, they change activity type every 2 seconds in a shift. So it's and the fact that it's very anaerobic and high intensity means that a typical shift for a player is only between 30 and 60 seconds. So they are on the field, on the ice for 30 to 60 seconds, and then they sit on the bench for a while and rest for between 2 and 4 minutes, and then they come in again. So it's very anaerobic on the ice for 30 to 60 seconds, and then they rest and recover and obviously need a relatively high capacity as well to recover between these high intensity bouts.
Tommy, can I just ask you, you mentioned a few seconds back that they change activity type every 2 seconds. What are the activity types you're talking about there?
You know, change of direction, turning, tackling. Right. So it's just the type. Yeah, it's of course, it depends on the definition. But, you know, change of direction, backwards, forward, etc. So it's very few activities that are, I mean, it's very, very rare, for example, that they would, you know, skate or sprint in one direction for longer than just a few seconds maximum. Mm-hmm. So it's very, you know, it's changing all the time, etc. So still, if you count like on-field performance during a game, they cover like, I think it's around 4,500 meters. So 4.5K during a game. And almost half of those meters are covered in high intensity. Sprinting has been defined above 24 kilometers per hour. And they do sprint skating about 500 meters per game. So it's quite high intensity. They certainly use the anaerobic energy sources like phosphocreatine and glycogen. Mm. Some studies suggest 60 to 70% glycogen depletion during a game. Hmm. But still, they have a relatively high VO2 max, like around 59-60 milliliters per kg on average. So it's, you know, it's not, of course, like endurance sports, but still relatively high, considering also that the weight of the players has increased in the last two decades from like 85 kilograms now up to closer to 90 kilograms on average. So they are relatively big players. Obviously physique is important. They do a lot of strength training. They lift quite heavy in the gym. They are strong, especially the defensemen. They are a little bit bigger than the forwards. The forwards can be a bit more mix of smaller players and bigger players. Defensemen typically a little bit bigger. And they play longer as well. So it's slightly more demanding to play as a forward. Typically, you have two defensemen and three forwards on the pitch.
So the training must be quite interesting, because if you have dual demands of high intensity efforts lasting 30 seconds, but continuously for an hour long in a match, do they polarize the training, or do they try and do mixed training that simulates matches more often? Or is that vary across the calendar year depending on the block that they're in?
Yeah, so my sort of experience is that ice hockey is quite like, it has followed a tradition and culture in terms of training for long. I think that's one of the things that we want to change a little bit now in Sweden, and part of my work with the Swedish Ice Hockey Federation as a consultant on physiology is maybe make the training a bit more game specific. It's been very traditional in terms of, you know, traditional strength and conditioning. They have an off season during the summer where they typically are not on the ice hockey rink. They train, you know, just in the gym and running and cycling, etc. So quite like traditional off pitch, off ice preseason training. During season, there are a couple of things that I think are interesting. First of all, it's the match demand is quite high. It's very common to play 3 games per week, so 2 to 3 games per week. So it's not, they can't train, you know, too much. Obviously, they need to recover and prepare for the games as well. But it's quite typical to have off ice fitness training throughout the year, and then during the ice training, typically the focus is not that much on the physiology. It's more the sort of head coach, the ice hockey coach, you know, they train, they prepare for the game tactically, they do power play training, etc. So I think that's one of the things I think could be a bit more like modern approach now, to actually look at the physiology of ice hockey and also implement physical training that corresponds better to the actual game demand, because, you know, obviously it's, they are on ice with skates. I mean, I don't think we can have a perfect transfer effect from, you know, running, cycling, these kind of off-ice training methods. So I think that's one of the interesting aspects that I think they can still improve their physical training for sure in ice hockey, I think.
Do they practice fighting?
So in Sweden, Sweden fights are not actually allowed. I think it's mainly allowed in the NHL, so in the professional hockey league in North America. So I don't think they practice it. Obviously, in the North America, they have a few play, at least back in the days, they, you know, a few players were in the squad mainly to go in when there were fights. I think that has changed a little bit now as well. But yeah, obviously it's a bit of a, I don't know, it's, I guess, part of the show in America too, with these fights. It's, as I said, it's not allowed, for example, in, I think, at least not in Sweden, but I don't think in the European leagues either. And obviously, you know, there are issues like medical issues. Like, we have a lot of concussions in ice hockey, for example. So there are some, you know, serious, you know, medical concerns as well with the, I mean, the concussions obviously are not mainly from the fights, but still in the game. So I think my guess is that the fights are going to disappear more and more.
I agree with you, actually. Yeah. My limited exposure to ice hockey has been through concussion, because, as you know, I work with rugby, and we have a group that includes the NHL and the International Hockey Federation, and they are addressing many of the same issues as we are. And the fight used to be part of the entertainment in the US, but I think it's unpalatable to have something that's not part of the game that might cause a brain injury and allow it. So I agree with you. I think that's going to be phased out.
But it's interesting with concussions, because actually we have similar rates of concussions in women's ice hockey, even though they have different rules. So you can't tackle in the same way you can in men's ice hockey. So in women's ice hockey, these sort of tackles against the rink, etc., are not allowed. But still they have similar rates of concussions. So it's not only in the sort of physical, you know, collisions, etc. It's also in just, you know, collisions during the game, etc. So it's not only during tackles that they get these concussions. But they have been successful in Sweden to decrease in the last years. Now they have this project called Zero Vision for concussions, so they have actually been able to decrease the number of concussions, and they're doing some research and work on the helmets, etc., as well, and obviously rule change, I think. Stuff that you, I guess some similarities with the rugby.
We're also struggling at the moment. We have limited data in women's rugby. It's growing very quickly, but the rugby picture is similar, that the forces and the speeds of contact in women's rugby are much lower, but the concussion rate's about the same, which suggests that they probably have a slightly higher risk to the same load. So it sounds quite similar. Tommy, if we think about the Winter Olympics that have happened, and I was actually, just before we came on, I was watching the ice hockey began this morning for us. The current champions were the team from Russia for the men, and the US, I believe, on the women's side. What makes the difference between elite teams in the Winter Olympics? Is there a physiological component to it, or is it more like football where everyone just focuses on tactics and skill?
I mean, to some extent, I think it's a combination. There is certainly like evidence that, you know, better teams are, they have better fitness. I'm not sure that would be evident if you take like the top, you know, eight teams in the Olympics, that you can actually, you know, discriminate them on fitness. That's probably more the, you know, game skills, tactics, you know, just player, like how good are the players. So it's kind of like, you know, when you're at the highest level in the Olympics and or in the top league, for example, I think everyone has relatively high fitness. So it's probably not going to be the physiological factors that makes, you know, the medalist. But certainly if you compare like Premier Division versus, you know, first or second division, etc., then you can certainly see that they have higher fitness in in the higher leagues for sure. But you know, it's a lot of, you know, ice hockey is a bit special that there's been like six big nations really for decades that have dominated. You know, it's Canada, USA, you have Sweden, Finland, you have Czech Republic and Russia. Those are the big six countries that basically share all the gold medals between them in the Olympics, in the World Cup. Obviously, one thing that is also a bit, I guess, special with ice hockey is that we have this professional hockey league in North America. And what will determine the success in an Olympic game, for example, and in World Cup sometimes, is how are the NHL players actually taking part in the tournament or not?
Yeah.
So some Olympics, they have had a break in an NHL and all players are available. And in some Olympics, none of the NHL players are available. So then it's really, you know, it's not the A team. It's the B or C team, because, you know, all the best players, they play in NHL in North America. And it's the same in the World Cup, which is typically in beginning of May. You know, they can only take the players from NHL that are not in the playoffs. Mm. So if their team, are beaten early in the NHL, they can go and play in the World Cup. But the best players or the best players from the best teams who go like to the quarterfinals, semifinals in the playoffs, they can't play in the World Cup. So it's a bit, you know, different in that way, because in many other sports, it would be, you know, unthinkable almost that you would not have the best athletes in an Olympic game or in a World Cup, for example. In like in football, soccer, that would be unimaginable.
I suppose the gravity of the NHL just sucks everyone towards it. It's so large and enormous. When you spoke earlier about fitness and you can assess that the best teams are fitter, what does fitness testing look like for an ice hockey player? I would imagine you would have to have, if you described previously that you need strength and power and a degree of anaerobic endurance, you need a combination of things that happen on the ice and off?
Yeah, so it's, again, it's been quite traditional in terms of, certainly the off-ice tests have dominated, like the Wingate 30-second sprint test is common, for example, where they do like at least 12 watts per kg. So certainly they are quite good at, Wingate or all-out sprinting on a bike. They do standard tests in the gym, like squat and stuff, but also the Cooper run test is common. It's, you know, more and more ice tests are developed, certainly like repeated sprint tests on ice. There is this version of the yo-yo intermittent recovery test on ice as well. So it's coming more and more. I think we have seen some data comparing on ice repeated sprint tests with off ice repeated sprint tests, for example. And the correlation is, you know, it's not that good. And what we also have seen is that in the Cooper run test, the 3K run test, for example, they perform better after the summer, after the preseason, when they have actually, you know, probably done some running. And then during season, we don't think that the sort of on-ice aerobic capacity is decreased, but they decrease in the Cooper run test. So I think that shows this, you know, specificity principle that I think they should put more emphasis on, you know, on-ice game-specific fitness training in the future.
When a coach is standing on the side of the ice and assessing when to make his changes, you spoke earlier, it's 30 to 60 seconds on, 2 to 4 minutes off. Does he has a plan. He knows that's going to happen. And all he's waiting for is an opportunity to do that safely so that he doesn't leave his team exposed, his goal exposed. Does a coach ever try and assess fatigue during a game, looking at the player and saying, actually, this player needs to go on for 20 seconds and spend 5 minutes off? Or do they just run it as a formula?
So I think, you know, first of all, the best players, they certainly play a a little bit more, a little bit longer than the other players. So I think it's a lot up to this sort of subjective feeling and rating of the players themselves. They probably, you know, tell the coach or that, okay, I need a rest, or I can't play, you know, every second shift now. I have to play every third shift or something. So typically they have three lineups that they go with. So that's why. But if you sometimes, like in the end of the game, the coach can decide that, okay, now we're just changing between these two lineups. So then obviously the recovery time between shifts is going to decrease, but you can't do that for a whole match probably. So, but my experience is that they are not very in the forefront in terms of technology, like using on like real time assessment, for example, during matches. Certainly like things like heart rate, etc., they can do it, but I don't think it's as advanced as we see in professional football or soccer, for example. It's more about coach feeling and player sensation, how they feel, etc. And like this communication between the coach and the players during the game. It's not, I don't think it's based on like data, for example.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Interesting. And so let's talk Winter Olympics. I mean, you've obviously been working with Sweden. Are there prospects of medals or no?
I mean, I'd say they almost always are. I don't think they are the favorite this year. They don't have... again, it's a tournament where they don't have the A team, I'd say. So many quite unknown players. But obviously, it's the same situation for other teams as well. So, and Sweden have won before when there's been, you know, this situation where there's almost no NHL players. I fondly remember 1994, for example, when Sweden won the Olympics. They also won 2006. So, I mean, they are almost always in the medal combat. But I think, you know, it's always these six nations. So, and it, quite often it's hard to tell, actually, before the tournament who's the stronger. You can maybe get some insights when the tournament starts, etc. But it's typically quite hard to predict. But it's almost always between these six nations, and you know, a few years Sweden are a bit stronger, Canada, etc. So it's Russia, obviously, like during the 80s, they dominated almost. So it's going to be interesting to see the ice hockey, but also the other sports. In we're obviously the Winter Olympics is big here in Sweden. We're doing pretty good now in cross country skiing and some other sports as well. So yeah, it's going to be exciting.
How do you watch ice hockey? Do you watch it with an analytical eye, or do you watch it as a fan and park your physiology while you watch it?
Certainly like more with the analytical eye now than before. I played myself, I can say, until I was like 14 or so. I chose football. But so, I mean, mainly before I just watched it like a... you know, general sports supporter. But certainly now, since I've been more involved with the Ice Hockey Federation in Sweden, I also watch more with the analytical eye. It's very interesting from a physiological perspective and many aspects. They also lose a lot of fluid, for example. They lose like between 2 and 4 kilograms of body weight during a match. So that's also one thing that I think they can improve a little bit more, because we know the high intensity activities go down a little bit in the third period of the game. So I think, you know, not losing too much fluid body weight can also be important in ice hockey, and something they can probably improve more. There's a lot of interesting aspects to look at now, I think, when we watch a game.
So give our listeners like two tips. You're watching it with an analytical eye. What are you looking at, for example, that our viewers, particularly those who aren't intimately familiar with the sport, can say, Okay, I've got insights in this now, thanks to Tommy and Science of Sport.
Obviously, it depends a little bit on the experience, I think, how much you've seen ice hockey before. I know the game a little bit more, I guess, since I've played, etc. myself. So you can watch, you know, how they form their team, you know, tactically in power plays, etc. I think in terms of the physiology, if you're slightly more sort of novice viewer of the game, it's just interesting to see the very different characters of the players. You know, some are small and very fast, you know, agility, technical. Some are just big, you know, with the they are very good to follow players, follow game, block them, tackles, etc. So just you see a very big, like, variety of physiology and physique on the pitch, and you can sort of see how that influence the game, and you know which. So they all have different, obviously, assets to the team depending on their physique and their skills, which I think it's quite interesting to see this mix.
Yeah, Tommy, thanks very much for your time, and looking forward to watching it with much more insight than I've ever had on ice hockey. And certainly we'll be rooting for Sweden because we've spoken to you. So thanks very much.
That sounds good. You should. Thank you.
Thanks, Tommy.
Well, fascinating there talking to Tommy Lindberg. And that sport of, for us in the Southern Hemisphere, we don't see much around the ice hockey, but in North America, it is absolutely huge, isn't it?
Yeah, Scandinavia, North America. Tommy spoke of the six countries. And I remember seeing in 2010, there was an unbelievably funny data or graphic that was released. I think it was by the Edmonton government, because in 2010, Canada were hosting the Winter Olympics, Vancouver. And they made it to the ice hockey final. And if memory serves me, it had been a long time since they'd won one. Yeah. And so the country, and ice hockey in Canada is religion. And so the whole country was watching this game. And the Edmonton Water Board produced a stat or a graph showing water consumption on the night of the final. And it starts off at like 400 megaliters or whatever per whatever. And then all of a sudden it just drops to next to nothing. Because that's when the face-off was. That's when the game starts. And then at the end of the first period, it climbs again back up to baseline because the whole country has gone to the bathroom at about the same time. And then after the second period, the same. And then when they did win this final, then there's a little dip, the medal ceremony. There's no water consumption again. And then after the medal ceremony, back to normal. And so the toilet flushing was synchronized in Canada for the period of that ice hockey final.
Sure. I bet there's a few sports like the what's the American NFL?
The Super Bowl will be the same.
It must be the same, yeah.
World Cup final if Brazil's playing.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's ice hockey in the north.
That's a good example of passion. Mm. Anyway, and we're going to turn our attention to the very complicated story around cross-country skiing and biathlon, and talking to Kieran McGrawley, who is somebody that's been very immersed in this space for a number of years and as pretty much an academic, but somebody that really understands the sport and the physiology in particular.
Yeah, so I got Dr. Kerry McGawley's number from Tommy. I said to him, you know, what other sports? Does he know anyone particularly in cross-country skiing? Because as cyclists, runners, you and I, the sport that we have most familiarity with or most in common with would be cross-country skiing, as you're about to discover, because we'll talk about comparisons with Kerry. And they have an amazing model in Sweden where they've got these towns that are set up to serve these Olympic athletes, basically.
Yeah.
And she found herself going there, someone who didn't speak Swedish and didn't know cross-country skiing. And over the course of the last decade, become one of the world leaders in it.
Yeah.
And so she's been working she was initially the director, and now she's a researcher at this Olympic Center, studying specifically biathlon, which involves a great deal of cross-country skiing. So no one better to pick the brains of around what, again, and I said this before, cross-country skiing is fascinating because it is so similar to the sports that we talk about most often on this podcast, and one of the sports that you can watch and appreciate most, even if you don't know it, at the Winter Olympics now in Beijing.
Well, you'll see both of the bios of our guests today on our show notes on the podcast. If you want to know more about them, check out the show notes and we'll give you more detail. But here is Kieran McGrawley talking about cross-country skiing and biathlon. Right, Kerry, welcome to the Science of Sport. Obviously, great to chat to you, particularly for us here in South Africa, and to talk about winter sports because a lot of it's very foreign to us here. And we're going to talk to you specifically around the sports of cross-country skiing and biathlon. But let's maybe kick off with the cross-country skiing things. For those that have no idea about cross-country skiing, what does the Olympic program look like for athletes that are competing in terms of distances and the disciplines?
Hi, thanks for having me. It looks very busy. When I started actually writing this down and like planning my next couple of weeks, I was like, wow, I got a lot to do. I don't know how I'm going to get my work in. They start on Saturday, so tomorrow as we're recording now, and the women and the men race separately. So on Saturday and Sunday, this first weekend is the skiathlon. And in cross-country skiing and biathlon as well, the men and the women race over slightly different distances. So the skiathlon is a combination of the two main cross-country skiing techniques. So you have classic skiing and you have skate skiing in cross-country. In biathlon, they only ski freestyle, which is the skate technique. But in cross-country skiing, they use a mixture of the two. So the skiathlon is a combination of the two. And the women ski 7.5K of classic first and then followed by skate, and the men ski 15 kilometers plus 15 kilometers. So they ski double the distance.
So just can you explain what those two disciplines are then, those two different styles?
Oh, right. Yeah. So the classic.
You've really got to dumb it down with us, you see.
No, that's cool. Yeah. The classic cross-country skiing, you might have seen it. It's in the parallel tracks. So it looks more like a running technique. The skis glide forwards and backwards in a linear motion. Whereas the skate is more like that kind of ice skating motion where the skis go out to the side. So the classic skiing has the grip kind of wax because as they push down through the foot, they need to grip onto something as they push through. Whereas the skating use a lot more the edges to push off the sides.
So yeah, right. I would imagine you'd want a longer ski on the classic, right?
Yeah, slightly.
Yeah, so in the skiathlon, people will see them come into a pit stop in effect and change?
Exactly, yeah. So they'll ski the classic first because then they're inside the tracks. And then, yeah, and you can actually lose a little bit of time and really mess up your race on that transition. So, yeah, they'll have their skis set up, they'll slide in, unclick. It looks a little bit like triathlon in a way, I guess, like unclick very quickly, get into their other skis. So they have a combination boot as well because in classic and skate, you would usually have a slightly different boot. There's a lot more ankle support on the skate ski because you're going over to the side. So in this one, they don't change their boots, but they use a combi boot. So that's the first event of very many, by the way.
Yeah, sorry. I know we're gonna get it's so interesting. We might take some time. Does the same skier tend to dominate both, or are they different enough that someone who comes outside the top 10 in one will be a medalist in another?
In the different styles, in the different techniques. Yeah, so this skiathlon, like our Swedish athlete, Charlotte Kalla, she's the reigning female champion in any case. She's a really strong skater and a less good. If you're a strong skater, it's good because with the classic, you can kind of, because they start off together in the classic, you can stay in the pack a little bit like cycling. You know what I mean? There's a lot of drafting in cross-country skiing. There's a real effect of drafting. So if you can stay with the pack on the classic and you're a stronger skater, you've kind of got an advantage because you can then take off a little bit more on the skate. And that's also, it's a really good event for our British skier, Andrew Musgrave, because he's a really strong skater. So if he can stay with the strong Norwegians and the Russians, for example, on that classic section, then he's got a good chance to do well on the skate. But I mean, all cross-country skiers, because all of the events, as we'll get on to later, all of the events, they sort of rotate for the Olympics and the World Champs. One year, a certain distance will be classic, and the next time of the running, it will be skate. So all cross-country skiers need to be equally good in both classic and skate, so you won't get specialists in those two. But what you will get is certain people who are naturally better at classic versus skate.
Right.
All right. So tell us about what happens after that. Once you've got that one down, what other disciplines do you have to deal with? There's a lot more.
Yeah, there are. Yeah. So that's just this weekend. Then on Tuesday of next week, it's the sprint cross-country. I'm just talking about cross-country for now. Like all of the biathlon are going in parallel with this. So they're fitting in around the same sort of days. But on Tuesday is the cross country sprint race. So that's really exciting. The men and the women race on the same day at the same sort of time in the schedule, but they alternate. So the women go first. So they'll have their prologue qualification race, which is an individual start race. And then the time from that prologue, if they get a good enough time in the top 30, they go on to the knockout stages. And then there's a quarterfinal, a semifinal and a final. And the men and the women get alternated so that it'll be the women's prologue, men's prologue, then a bit of a break. They get a rest. Women's quarter, men's quarter, women's semi, men's semi, women's final, men's final.
And each race, if I remember correctly, because I watched this in 2018, and I have to say it was probably one of the most exciting mornings of sports I've ever had. I've never been so immersed in an event for so long, because what happens is you'll see the prologue, so you'll learn the course. Because the course will be how long? They're taking 5 or 6 minutes, I think, if I remember right.
No, they take about three. It's kind of 2 to 4 minutes.
Even quicker.
Yeah, and the course is about 1.5 kilometers, so it's about 1 to 1.8 kilometers. It doesn't have to be fixed, but it has to be in those margins.
So what happens is you learn the course, and so you recognize, okay, they're about to hit the steep little incline, and you know there's going to be an attack there because you've seen it in all the prologue, all the qualifications. So by the time you get to the semi and the final, it's like you know the characters, and you know more or less the stage, and you anticipate, and it's a story that develops over the course of a morning for us here in South Africa anyway. And I just found it fascinating. Plus, the physiology must be unbelievable because you're asking endurance athletes to sprint and repeat that over and over.
Yeah, it's awesome. I love it. And in Pyeongchang, we also won gold in the women's event. Stina Nilsson won that, who is now, by the way, very interestingly, with the biathlon team in Beijing. So she transitioned between these two Olympic cycles. But yeah, I love the sprint. And we've actually got, like, our women are amazing at it. We've done lots of research on the sprint, like, so looked a lot into the tactics, the pacing strategies, the physiology. So, I love it too. I think it's fascinating, just like you do. And there's kind of different, I guess, demands of each of the rounds as well. And they have to be quite savvy because the whole event itself takes about 3 to 4 hours. And yeah, you're right. I mean, it's only like 2 to 4 minute bouts four times if you're going to win the event. But that's like sort of a 1500 meter runner being expected to back up four 1500s, sort of 800, 1500 within the space of 3 or 4 hours. So you've got to be really careful with your sort of energetics and your recovery. The prologue, they can be a little bit smart and start to pace. If they're really good, if they know that they're in the sort of top five, top 10, they can pace their prologue a little bit so that they don't, you know, use up all their energy or they don't fatigue too much in the prologue. It's a bit more of a chilled recovery and then they've got more to give. But in the World Cup races, they've changed the points. So you get extra bonus points if you do well in the prologue to try to stop athletes from doing that. And they've also got a really cool tactical system where the better you do in the prologue, because you get to choose which quarterfinal you go into, the better you do in the prologue, the better options you get of which quarterfinal you pick. And obviously, you want to pick, we've done a study on this actually, it's just come out in the last month. You want to pick one of the first two quarters because there's 5 quarterfinals. You want to pick one of the first two because that puts you into the first semi and that just extends your rest from the quarter to the semi and then from the semi to the final, because those rest periods are down to like, by between the semi and the final, then you're down to 15, 20 minutes. And that difference between doing the first or the semi, we found in our study to be crucial for performance, like by 5%.
Yeah. What do they do when they finish and they have qualified for the semi-final from the quarters or for the final from the semi? Do they try anything to accelerate the recovery, or is it actually just better to sit down, get your mind ready, and then stay warm?
If you're at the stadium, you'll see like the bigger teams, you'll see like Monarch cyclogometers, you know, like lined up out there. So they'll sit on a bike if that's available to them and just spin over easily. So they will do some active recovery and then they'll have some passive recovery and then they'll also have some sort of nutrition. Yeah, there'll be some sort of nutrition between each one usually as well. And that will get down to just sort of like carbo gels or stuff in between those later ones. But it's quite crucial from the prologue to the quarter is like a couple of hours. So there it's quite important, like their nutrition, to keep it topped up all the way through.
Mm. And you say that's Tuesday?
Yeah, that's Tuesday, yeah.
So that's my Tuesday morning sorted.
And the guys that do that spin stuff, I mean, they're obviously specialists in that particular discipline. They don't go to any of the other cross-country disciplines.
They do, yeah. So if you imagine it, so it's actually extremely aerobic, the sprint, because it's, first of all, it's 2 to 4 minutes, so that's already predominantly aerobic. The recovery is hugely aerobic. But yeah, the anaerobic components are crucial. So that sprint finish is crucial. And like you said, Ross, like there's little kind of kicks or bits of hills, and they're always crucial as well. So it's always those explosive anaerobic sections that are crucial for the winner, even though it's a really aerobic sport. So Stina Nilsson, who won at the last Olympics, and Claire Bow from Norway won the men's race. Stina actually also got, what did she get? She got bronze in the 30 kilometer mass start race. So the other end, which we'll come on to later, and that was very similar with the Norwegian Petter Northug, who's like kind of one of the biggest, I guess, profiles in cross-country skiing. He was an awesome sprinter. Lots of them are good all the way through, but they're also good in the mass start, because that's more, again, like a, imagine like a cycling race. It's about 2 hours, but it's mass start, so they can, there's a lot of drafting and pack racing, and then oftentimes it comes down to a sprint finish after 2 hours. So again, that's got a similar kind of idea to a cycling race, if you know what I mean, that if you can just stay in the pack, it comes down to the best sprinters at the end.
Right. I was going to say it's analogous to watching a Tour de France and seeing someone finish 180K winning a sprint, and then a week or two later watching that athlete in the Olympic Games winning a track medal, for instance.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing with cross-country skiing that makes it more tricky for preparation, that makes it more interesting for us as physiologists, is the topography. So it's always, it has to have a third uphill, a third flat, and a third downhill pretty much in the courses. That's how the courses have to be structured according to the rules. So you've always got hills and lots of technical issues to cater for as well. And that's what, these athletes are so interesting, because yeah, like you said, you would imagine, I couldn't believe it when I first came to Sweden. I was like, what are these guys doing? Why don't they specialize? And it's a traditional thing that they don't, but also there's so much crossover between the events, even though they're 2 minutes to 2 hours.
Wow. So I appreciate that there's obviously a lot of crossover, and physiology to a large degree constrains who can succeed where. But do you think, having been involved almost as, and I mean, don't let me put words in your mouth, but as an outsider, do you think over the next decade that will change enough that there will be specialists? Because even if specializing gives you 2 or 3%, that's clearly going to make a significant difference.
Yeah, I don't know if it will happen more and more. It is happening already. Like, so we've clearly got, within our Swedish squad, we've clearly got, especially on the female side, women who are just standout world champion sprint skiers, and then standout world champion distance skiers, as you would call them, which is the sort of 10, 15K and the skiathlon that we already talked about. Not necessarily the mass start, because the mass start is similar to the sprint, like I said. So that does happen already. But the thing is, then you get athletes like Johannes Klæbo, who's a Norwegian skier, who's just winning everything. And I think because technique is such a big part of this, equipment is such a big part of it as well, that if you've got a good team around you and you've got a great technique in the two, classic and traditional, you can be really good across the board. But yeah, that they do specialize to some degree already. Whether that's going to get more and more I guess distinct, I don't know, we'll have to wait and see. But it was definitely something that, me coming into the sport as an outsider from the UK that had never really been involved in it, like growing up, I was pretty blown away to begin with that they didn't specialize more.
Sure. Okay, let's move through the distances then. So you've got this sort of sprint stuff, what's next on the schedule?
Yeah, so then it's the classic kind of race, which is the classic sort of and I say classic in another way now, like traditional, the distance race, and that's 10 kilometers for women and it's 15 kilometers for men. And that's the traditional race where the good, like outstanding, like distance skiers will win. So typically that will be a different person who's won the sprint and is likely to win the mass start race typically. But it could be somebody who's won the skiathlon because the distances are quite similar. So the women all ski 10 where they skied 15 in skiathlon. The men all ski 15 where they skied 30, and it's one of those techniques only. So this year in Beijing, it's classic skiing. So it was skate in Pyeongchang last time.
All right, that's sorry, am I correct in did I understand you correctly that that's not a mass start?
No, that's individual start, yeah.
So it's effectively a time trial, and they go off at one-minute increments, or does it change over the course as you get to the favourites?
No, it stays the same, but they do it according to rankings. So they have, like, different blocks of skiers going at different times so that you would never have, like, the top two skiers or the top block of good skiers one behind the other. There'll always be a lower ranked kind of, like, filtered in between them. And I'm pretty sure it's 30-second intervals.
And does the weather make a significant difference? Can you get lucky with your start time? Because I would imagine the first person goes off an hour, maybe 2 hours before the last, and that could change, A, the terrain of the course, and B, the weather.
Yeah, it does. And it wouldn't be that spread out. On a World Cup, it could be more. I don't know what the cap of the Olympics is, but there's typically fewer athletes anywhere in the Olympic race. But it might be like an hour for sure between the first and the last, if not slightly more. And yeah, you're totally right. If it's snowing a lot, that affects it even more. If there's no kind of precipitation and it's fairly stable conditions, not a lot's going to happen. But you can imagine as well, the course gets a bit churned up. So that will make it slower. So oftentimes the later you are. But yeah, you're totally right. If the temperature changes, if the snow precipitation changes, and then the effects of people that have gone ahead can affect the course. So it does. But they'll always try to, in the way of it getting churned up naturally, then they'll try to make it beneficial for the likely winners in how they do the start times.
So, I mean, here in South Africa, we obviously have a big culture around ultra-distance running, but we've had lots of Europeans participating in our ultra-distance races. I remember a chap by the name of Charlie Dole, who was the winner of the Comrades Marathon here. He was a massive cross-country skier when he was training in the off-season, and a lot of the Europeans do that. Talk us through the physiology of the sort of, I think the distance skiers seems to be the one that we know the best in terms of us understanding what they do. But what is required for them to be good distance skiers?
Yeah, it's quite similar to running and cycling and other kind of endurance sports. So there's quite a lot of literature on this, and we've done quite a lot of studies ourselves. So it's the typical VO2 max, the fractional utilization, so that kind of lactate threshold type stuff, how close to your VO2 max you can hold for, you know, as long as possible. It's economy. So we do measure efficiency and economy. We've got a huge treadmill in our lab that you can cross country skate on with roller skis. So obviously a lot shorter than the full ski. And lots of labs that focus on this type of work will have those. And then also its anaerobic capacity is a huge part because of the topography. Like, you've got lots of ups and downs and you've got sprint finishes. So in that capacity, it's a little bit more like, I guess, something like mountain biking, or, like, you know, you wouldn't necessarily compare it with track running from that perspective, because that anaerobic component is so important because they're going above their VO2 kind of maximal aerobic capacity a lot of the time when they're skiing uphill. And we've got measurements of that. They might be up at 160% of VO2 max for some sort of climb of a hill. And then they've got the possibility to replenish that kind of anaerobic energy stores on the flatter sections and the downhills. And then there might be tactical components as well where they need to get past somebody. So yeah, it's those classic VO2 max, fractional utilization, skiing efficiency, which is obviously affected by technique. It's the anaerobic power kind of capacity. And then they do a lot of strength work. It's a whole body sport, as you can imagine. But people then obviously often think that's arms and legs. Their core is unbelievably strong. So there's a lot of core. On classic skiing, there's a lot of, like, double poling, which is kind of like this bouncing backwards and forwards. And then the very specific attributes depend Yeah, I mean, you talked about distance there, but also it will depend on whether it's an individual or a mass start that we've already talked about, and slightly which of the two techniques, classic or skate, it is. So that's what kind of most of the literature has shown, that's just done very simple, like correlational analyses between laboratory kind of determinants, laboratory measures, and performance. We've actually just published a paper in MedSci using quite a lot more advanced like statistical techniques, and used lots of, because we've got a huge database from all of these world-class athletes, like, as you can imagine, because we're kind of the test center. And we've done the largest study of these kind of predictive kind of attributes that there is. And we actually really struggled to find clear determining factors of performance over time. So we've looked at both developmental athletes over a period of years and looked at what attributes need to develop in order for phys points. So they're kind of, you know, standardized. FIS is the International Ski Federation, so it's their ranking system for those points to improve, what laboratory factors or anthropometrical factors need to improve. And we don't find any predictive models for the men at all, which is weird. Like, so we've got in there, we've got body composition, lean mass, fat mass, we've got their age, and then we've got all the things I already mentioned to you, VO2 max, lactate threshold, and so on. For the women, we found predictive models, and this was both for cross country and biathlon, by the way. For the women in both sports, we found predictive models, and then it was like I said, VO2 peak was one of the most important characteristics. Their speed at 2 and 4 millimoles of the lactate concentration, and then lean body mass, so body composition, lean body mass, a lower fat mass, and a lower body mass into a higher body mass, but. The lean body, that's a really difficult one to kind of talk to the athletes and the coaches about with the female athletes. So that's been a bit of a sensitive one. And then on the biathlon side, shooting performance comes into that model as well. Mm. But I don't want to kind of overcomplicate it, but it's quite interesting that we've done quite an in-depth study. And there's the second paper is currently in review with MedSci as well. But the first one, like, has been published, but it kind of goes against, I guess, those more simple models. So I think, I think it's complicated. And I think there's more to it than just saying these are the most important things. But obviously you need to have a basically high VO2 peak and a very high fractional utilization, a very good technique and a very good anaerobic power. There's no getting away from that.
I'd have thought that it fairly unsurprising that there's no predictive element there, because you can put together the same performance in different ways. So in running and cycling, for instance, there's an inverse relationship between economy and max, which is logical, because if you're inefficient, your max is likely to be higher and vice versa. So I wonder whether you've looked, for instance, there was a study came out when that sub 2-hour marathon, where they found that the best marathon runners are maintaining, I think it was in the range of 87% to 90% of their VO2 max for 2 hours. That would seem to be an important one, but you're saying not even that stands out.
For the women, the speed at their 2 and 4 millimole values stands out, which would be something similar, I guess.
Yeah, fair.
But you're right. I still would think that, because I've always thought that about runners or any endurance athletes, that yeah, you can have a higher this and a lower that, and you can account for it, but surely those athletes that are killing it at the very top really have got an extremely high, to the point of nearly as high as the highest in at least two, if not more, of those kind of areas. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting, Matt.
I mean, they are. I mean, what is the distance of the races? You know, when they say they're doing 10 and 15 kilometers, how long do they take to do that?
About half an hour.
Oh, wow. Okay.
For the 10 or the 15? Sorry, was that?
About the same. So.
Oh, because the men do the 15 and okay.
Yeah. And I mean, the men take a bit longer because they're not that much faster than the women, that 15Ks is equivalent in time to 10Ks. So the women will typically be a bit under 30 minutes and the men might be around that or a bit over. Mm. And that depends on the ski conditions quite a bit as well.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Russ, I mean, just from a, perspective that we come from, it's as close to cycling as probably anything, because you need that very high aerobic ability. And it's right up there with top cyclists in terms of what they can do, because you get, obviously you get climbing cyclists and you get guys who can sprint, but physiologically there's a high VO2 max that is a similarity between them all.
Yeah, but I would imagine, and I'm no expert on this, but the muscle contractions are different because they're not the same repetitive cyclical concentric contractions. So what is the biomechanics of cross-country skiing? That must make it in some ways more similar to running. So it's actually it lies between the two. So certainly cardiovascularly, it's the equivalent of cycling, but mechanically it's not.
Mm. Yeah, you're right, Mike. Like I've always felt, because I'm a triathlete, I race triathlon, so I kind of know running and cycling and swimming really well. So when I kind of first got into cross country, I was kind of doing those comparisons as well. And I do feel that it's very similar to cycling from that perspective, because there's no eccentric kind of, there's no impact like there is in running, for example. In that respect. So from that muscular perspective, I feel also that because you don't have that kind of stretch shortening in the same way as you do in running. But the two sports, it's quite interesting. Like the biathletes in the off season who do skate, by the way, they max out on cycling. They do tons of cycling. That's more their kind of summer off season training. They do loads of roller skiing as well, and they'll go to snowy places too. But whereas the cross-country skiers have traditionally done a lot more running, and they'll liken classic skiing, which the cross-country skiers do, to a running motion. It's much more like it's a linear kind of running motion. But even though they do as much skate as they do classic, they do a lot more running than they do cycling in the off season. That's probably changed a little bit over time, and some of the biathletes, a lot of our skiers and biathletes train together because they're at the same sort of level. But yeah, I'm just trying to think what we're talking about, the biomechanics. Yeah, I mean, I'm not a biomechanist. I have done some biomechanical testing and studies.
Well, I was just thinking in terms of, especially in the classic, at some point you would have hip extension. Cycling is almost always in hip flexion. You'd also have much larger range around the ankles. And so, but you've just said yourself that the movement more closely resembles running when you do classic style.
Yeah, you're right. And the hip extension is massive. And I can tell you that the three best distance skiers at the moment on the women's side, Therese Johaug in Norway and two of our female skiers, Frida Karlsson and Ebba Andersson, have been like elite runners. Like they could have been runners. Certainly Ebba and Therese. Therese, I think she didn't go. I think she'd qualified for Tokyo 10K or so. So they're kind of like that level of running.
How important is aerodynamics? And I'm not, you mentioned already drafting, but I'm thinking more around the, where they do effectively a time trial and whether the suit has evolved in a way that might give some teams advantages over others. Or is it too slow for that?
They don't focus on it very much. And sometimes I'm a little bit surprised about that. I mean, we work with alpine skiers as well, and we've got a wind tunnel on our campus. So we do lots of work with the alpine skiers on their aerodynamics and a lot on their tech, like you said, the suits. They do wear, the suits have become tighter, like any sort of athletic event, I would say, over time. Like there's less, like back in the days, if you see those old school photos, there's like flappy, like ski jackets and flappy stuff. They don't have any of that anymore. So they're in very, very like tight suits. So their suits are very aerodynamic from that perspective, but they don't do a lot of like tech and testing on more specifically aerodynamic equipment or kind of even positions. I would say the position, I haven't seen any literature at all or seen any testing, we don't do it in our labs, of like looking at their aerodynamic positioning on descents. But I mean, if you watch tons of it, and they've obviously kind of evolved through their coaching and their training, and they've kind of evolved the fact that they get, obviously when they do descend, they're in a tuck position. And you won't see any particular athletes necessarily getting away because of their tuck position per se. because it's quite easy to stay with. The most important factor there, without a shadow of a doubt, is the ski waxing and the skis and the ski waxing is so much more. Yeah. And that's so much more important. Sorry.
Yeah, there was a rumor, or at least there was coverage of it in South Korea, that the Norwegians had a waxing method that was giving them advantages over everyone else. And I don't know how well placed you are to comment on that, or at least explain why that could be an issue.
Recently, the waxing and the ski prep and the ski choice is huge. It's like it's an entire science on its own.
Yeah.
So if you go to any race, big events, World Cups, Olympics, the Norwegians, the Swedes, the big teams, they've got massive like articulated lorries, like trucks, ginormous trucks, like rows of them, filled up with skis and wax and technicians. And the technicians are they don't have sports scientists. But at all, they have ski technicians. That's the most important thing for them. Huh. And they'll be out there now, like they are out there now. They're testing hundreds of pairs of skis for those conditions, for those athletes on those days, according to what the temperature is going to be, et cetera, et cetera. So it's huge. And firstly, there's the skis themselves, the actual ski, and they'll test lots of them. And then they'll kind of structure the bottom of the ski in a certain way. And then they'll use wax on top of that structure. And there's different types of waxes for different types of conditions, but there's also different qualities of waxes. And I don't know if this is the reason or the thing that you were talking about specifically in this example, Ross, but there's this kind of floor wax, which is extremely, it's basically like gold dust wax. which is extremely expensive, and only the very most like wealthy teams, which is basically Norway, can afford this stuff, or you know, all the teams are using it, but it turns it into a huge kind of contest of who's got the most resources. So I'm not an expert on waxing and equipment at all. Like I have to get someone else to do mine basically. But I think they've banned this now because it's too much of a deciding factor. So it's a little bit like, you know, the swimsuits in swimming. Right. It's just too much of a factor. And also, I think the other reason that this might even be the main reason that they've banned it is because I think it's got environmental impacts, like it's negative for sustainability of the environment, for example. I think that might be an even bigger factor.
I'm sure it is. We've seen that sports governing bodies are reluctant to do anything, so I'm sure that might be the thing that helped them make the right decision.
Are there different? I mean, are skis? I mean, that sounds like a really silly question, but obviously in cycling we talk about carbon fiber and aluminium and steel. I mean, what are the skis made out of, and how can they differ?
Yeah, I guess that all of the skis now are pretty much the same. I'm out on a limb here because I don't know too. I mean, I'm pretty sure that they're kind of carbon. I don't know. When I look at mine, I've got like when the top starts running or rubbing away, they're like wood. I think they're wood. Mm. I'm not too sure.
Some sort of composite.
I'm not too sure. Yeah, and there's like I guess like the boots are carbon. I know that the ski boots, and that's kind of been a development over time. And now the boots have got really seriously quite advanced. I don't know if it would be carbon like underneath.
Mm. But it's a particular art form, yeah.
Yeah,
I guess skiing is a little bit like finding what works for you in terms of whether if the ground is rough, you obviously need a ski that is more flexible or less flexible. So the conditions dictate the kind of ski that you would use on any given day.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And like I said, like all the skis look that they're the same. It'll be the same company. So, you know, like different skiers have got different sponsorship deals. So I don't know if you've seen like the interviews at the end, but they're very quick to get their skis facing with their Salomon or whatever brand it might be. Mm-hmm. But there's kind of a few top brands and that's it. So it's a little bit like biking from that perspective. And all of the skis will look the same. But it's like you said, the way that they're made in the factories. And so the factories kind of will make them, and then certain sets of skis will be set aside for professional athletes. All the rest will go into the shops for people like us to buy. So like all of my skis, for example, are kind of ex elite skier skis that like a knock-top. So I'll just happen to have much better skis maybe than somebody that's bought a pair off a shelf at the shop. But they look exactly the same. And then also, I think the way that they're made, they can try and tell, but they can't tell to the nth degree that these skiers and the testing teams can tell these differences. But it's exactly like you say, it's the amount of kind of flex, and that also, it's quite related to the body weight of the athlete, for example, and like you said, the topography of the course. So they spend hours and hours, they'll like go ski to the top of like a hill, and then they do lots of gliding tests as well, and they'll see how well they glide on just the ski, and then on the structure, and then on the different waxes. So yeah, like this is a major full-time process for a huge team of people.
Sure. Take us through a typical week of a cross-country distance skier. What does the training look like? Let's talk about a competitive season rather than off-season.
There's some nice studies that have come out from like some of the Norwegian groups down in Oslo and up in Trondheim. We've done some stuff as well. And I mean, in a year, these top skiers, so there's a paper by Tønnesen, and he talks about like the road to gold. I don't know if you've seen it, Ross, but there's kind of, it's all of the kind of training and peaking that they'll do throughout the course of a season leading up to the best performance that they've had of the very top, like world-class skiers. But they'll train sort of about 800 hours per year, like annually.
Training, or does that include the weight work? Is that everything?
Yeah, that's kind of all of their training, but about 90% of it will be aerobic type of, including high intensity interval training, but about 90% of it will be kind of aerobic endurance based training. And of that 90%, about 90% of that will be intensity. So they use a very polarized kind of training process. So it'll be about 90% at low intensity, sort of 80 to 90. And then you'll have that kind of five-ish in that kind of moderate intensity area. And then sort of 5 to 10% will be at high intensity or high intensity kind of interval work. And then, yeah, the other 10% of their training will be other, which will be sort of strength, mobilization, yeah, functional strength work. And it will depend on the type of the time of year. Most of it is sport specific. So most of it is skiing or roller skiing in the summer is one of their main kind of like modes of training. And then, like I said, they'll run and they'll cycle as well. So that they'll be kind of their main modes of exercise. About a year and a bit ago, I examined a PhD on the whole PhD was a case study basically of Marit Bjørgen, who's the most successful cross-country skier in the world, according to kind of medals, but she's actually also the most successful Olympian ever of any summer or winter sport. So she's pretty decent. And she's really interesting because she also gave birth like either side of her career, and she had a long career. So it's quite interesting how her training evolved over time, pre-giving birth and having a child, and post to that, but also as she aged, you know what I mean? And she didn't need to do so much of that, those base hours anymore. And it got a little bit more refined. And there's other kind of examples of that from our skiers that as they've got older, they need to do less of that like base volume and they can really reduce their training load. But in some of those papers, like her five most successful years, I think she had like, I think it was reported 937 or something. So 950, let's say, training out. Like it was more training hours annually than had been reported previously. And then there was a big kind of thing of everyone started to say, oh my God, I've got to train more. I just got to load on like tons more training. Which obviously a bit. So they train a lot of hours, probably more than any other sport, maybe not triathlon, who's got three different kind of disciplines. But yeah, I mean, so the training week will be a lot of long, slow sessions. It will be one or two like high intensity interval sessions. And we haven't talked about biathlon at all. I mean, obviously it differs quite a bit for biathlon because they have to get in a lot of shooting as well. Yeah. And then they'll do kind of altitude training camps. I mean, it's similar to other endurance athletes, I guess.
Mm. And what are the two or three injuries that a cross-country skier is most likely to be sidelined by?
There's a lot of Landrug. I just have the words in Swedish. Would it be like this lumber? But it's a lot of back injury. Like they get a lot of slip disc type stuff.
Constant flexion and extension. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I guess there's like shoulders. They don't get in. Yeah, the back is the main issue, I would say, like thinking about the issues that we have in our squad. Some shoulder stuff. And yeah, some stress fractures actually is not kind of uncommon.
Despite that's a compression type stress fracture in the back, I would have thought, because there's not really impact. So it'll be.
Yeah, I wonder if they're getting that, because some of the girls are getting it. I wonder if they're getting that from like more their off season running. We've done one of my PhD students, he works with more their kind of illness and what's affecting their illness, but I haven't done any work personally on injury. I just see what I see through our physios and our athletes.
Sure. Just a complete aside, and I know I'm moving off the topic slightly. You talked about that athlete just a few moments ago. Was she better as an athlete before the baby or after the baby?
Well, she was pretty much world champion and everything before. So she couldn't really get much better, but she did sustain it. And now she's gone over to, like, because one thing we haven't talked about and we won't talk about is there's also long distance ski marathon racing, which is a whole nother thing. It doesn't come into the Olympics. So it's a little bit, Ross, like, for example, well, both of you, it's a little bit like, you know, you've got the ITU with triathlon,
and then
you've also got the Ironman. So, yeah. So it's a little bit like the Ironman split off thing. So they're not supported by their nations in the same way as triathlon is. And so lots of athletes might go over to that once they sort of retire from traditional distance skiing. So she's done that. So she was as successful afterwards, but in a different way. And that was what was quite interesting, was that she achieved it using different methods, which is quite interesting just from a sort of training principles perspective, really.
So if I remember correctly, she won her last Olympic medal in 2018, right? Or was it before that? I may have lost track. And then obviously has retired. But that was as a 37-year-old, I think it was. So she'd be in her 40s now?
Yes, she's a really good sprinter. So she was interesting. She was one of those ones that was a really good sprinter, but then also one that, what she won in Pyeongchang that you just said there, Ross, she won the women's 30-kilometer mass start race. And I'm just trying to think where I'm pretty sure she medaled, maybe got silver in the skiathlon. So she got quite a few medals, even in Pyeongchang at the last one. But yeah, I can't remember how old she was, but yeah, like late 30s.
So you can keep going into your late 30s at least. But then I remember also you mentioned his name earlier. Kleibo was the guy that won the sprint. He was in his early 20s in 2018, I think. He was new on the scene then. So the age range is the point I'm getting at. It seems like you can start in your early 20s and you can have a 20-year career.
Yeah, and we've got like a world champion. One of our girls is Frida Karlsson. She was, I think she wasn't even 20 when she won, maybe as a senior. This is her first Olympics and she's really young. And even Ebba Andersson, she was 20 at the last Olympics and got fourth, I think, in the skiathlon. So you're right, like it's a really big range.
Interesting, because cycling, of course, they used to say you got to earn your way into elite peak in your late 20s, and then you've got a 5 or 6 year career, but this seems to be wider.
Yeah, that's also changed because of Pogacar. There's also fairly young athletes, I suppose, that are always outliers in every sport.
You've got Valverde and so on. I think many sports are actually changing the age of typical success, which is another interesting conversation.
Let's talk a little bit about biathlon. I know we haven't touched on it too much, but you know, there are obviously similarities in terms of the skiing component, but talk us through how that works. I mean, we know that they stop and they have to shoot at targets. I read up a little bit about it and Ross sent me some stuff yesterday. I mean, you have to be incredibly accurate just to make it through the qualifying rounds. How does it work?
Just the sport in general.
Yes, and what is the Olympic program
like? Because they also... on the skiing, I'll come on to that right away, but on the skiing, there's also just quickly finish and summarize. There's a relay. So we got to the 10 and the 15K. After that, there's a relay, then there's a team sprint, and then there's the mass start. So we can put that sort of to the side.
I have to ask, is the relay mixed? Is the relay mixed, or is it men run a relay and the women?
In cross country skiing, it's men's 4x10 kilometers and women's 4x5 kilometers. So that's not mixed. And the team sprint is two sprint athletes, and they're also same sex.
Okay.
And they, one does the loop and then they tag, and then the next one does the loop and they do that six loops. So they do it three times each.
Mm-hmm.
So that's more continuous than the other sprint competition.
Mm.
And how long does the mess start?
For men, it's 50K. 50. And for women, it's 30. Yeah. So the 50K takes about 2 hours if the conditions are, you know, normal, pretty decent. And yeah, the women, it will be slightly under 2 hours. And that's 30K. And that's the one that Marit Bjørgen that we were talking about there won at the last Olympics. And that was classic last time. And that must have been skate last time. It's classic. Hang on a second. Yeah.
But it alternates.
Hang on, it was classic last time, so it must be freestyle this time. Yeah. Because Ivar Niskanen, the Finn, he won it at the last Olympics, and he's an outstanding classic skier. So he's an interesting one because he's an outstanding classic skier, but never really wins in skate. But his classic skiing is like, he's the guy you want to look at if you want to see how classic skiing should look like.
Mm.
But you're right, we should go across, yeah, if you want, we should go across to the battle.
Just tell us a bit about that. I know we're running out of time a bit, and I know you're very busy because your athletes are competing tomorrow. So yeah, just run us through it.
Oh, it's fine for me. But yeah, so interestingly, with biathlon, the very first event, which is tomorrow, Saturday, that's the mixed relay. So we just said that in cross country, they don't have a mixed relay, but in biathlon, they do have a mixed relay. And that's 4x6K. And I had a call actually with one of my PhD students. She's a biathlon specialist. I had a call with her yesterday just to get some of my facts straight because it's so complicated, all of the intricacies of the biathlon races. So, I said, but Marlon, why is it 4x6K? It's not always 4x6K. It depends if the men go first or the women go first, and that changes from race to race. So tomorrow at the Olympics, it will be woman, woman, man, man, and it will be 4x6 kilometres. And obviously they just skate. But I mean, the main thing, just to kind of summarise all the races, the main thing with biathlon is that they always start with their skis. They carry their rifle the whole time on their back. They set off always with a ski loop first. Then they come into the shooting range and they'll shoot. They'll go off and ski again. They'll come in and shoot. So they shoot at least twice, but most often four times, and that's interspersed with those skiing loops. So there's always one more, and then they always finish up with skiing and then cross the line on their skis. So there's always one more ski loop than there is shooting bout. And so I think that was the main thing I was thinking of. The rifle's got a certain weight. It has to be at least 3.5K, so it's relatively heavier for the women than for the men. And yeah, I mean, there's lots of other things I'm sure we'll come on to, but they also alternate whether they lie down and shoot or stand up and shoot. And they do at least one of each in every competition. But again, oftentimes two. And whether they lie down, stand up alternately, or lie down twice and stand up twice, depends on the event of the competition. So you'll see, when you watch the races, if you really get into it, you'll see all these different permutations and it'll blow your mind. But there is a structure to what they're doing, but it's different for every race.
And the targets are the same distance away, but are smaller when prone, the lying down. Do I have that right? Because I read something saying that the accuracy is about the same for standing and lying, but the targets aren't the same.
Yeah, exactly. The diameter is larger when you're standing up. Yes.
And a missed shot invites a 1 minute. Well, it's not a standardized penalty because they actually have to do a little penalty loop before they get back onto the main course. That's how I recall watching it work.
Yeah, and that is different for every single race as well, what they have to do. So the penalty differs for every race. So the mixed relay tomorrow, for example, and the relays, they're a bit kinder, because you're going to have some athletes who are significantly weaker in the team, and they try not to make that completely destroy the whole competition, if you know what I mean. So they're a bit kinder. So with both the mixed relay, which is on Saturday, and then you've got the men's relay and the women's relay, that's 10 days ahead. In both of those races, every athlete, because there's five targets that you have to knock down, regardless, that's always the same. So they come into the shooting range, they'll fire off their five shots, they'll try and hit all five. And then on both of the relays, they've got three extra shoot bullets that they can use, but they have to load them up. So the five are already there, five, use them up. If they've missed one, let's say, they can take out one of their extra bullets, put load it up and shoot again. If they miss it again, they can go again. They've got three extra bullets in the relays. If they use all of those up and they've still got targets not hit, then they go into the, what we call the Strafrunde, the penalty loop.
Right.
And they have to start going around that as many times as they've missed. But those three extra shots, bullets, are only available in the relay races. Mm. All of the other races, so the sprint, the pursuit, and the mass start, you take your five shots. If you miss any, however many you miss, that's how many penalty loops you have to do. And there's a third alternative in the longer distance race. So the distance race, or we call it the individual race. I don't know why they call it individual, because the sprint is also individual, but let's call it the distance race. Then they take their five shots. If they miss any, there's no penalty loop. They just get a 1 minute penalty time penalty per shot missed. So that race is much more effective because a penalty loop doesn't take a minute. It takes less than a minute. So if you miss in the individual distance race, it's heavier. It's more expensive, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, sure.
So there can be more shock results on that. There can be more like surprise results, because a really good athlete might all of a sudden just have a bit of a shocker on the shooting, and all of a sudden is kind of out of the game because they get this really heavy penalty of a minute.
If you get that 1 minute penalty, do they make you stay in a spot for a minute like they do in a triathlon, or do you keep racing, which is then confusing because the viewer is watching two athletes finish together, but one of them's 2 minutes behind the other one?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is. You don't get a rest.
Yeah.
So you don't get an advantage of getting rested up. You just get added on time at the end. Yeah, there's also, that also happens in the mass start, because there's only 30 mats and ranges, sort of lanes in the range. In the mass start, they have 30 who start, let's say the pursuit. So they have a pursuit race, which is based on the results from the sprint race beforehand. Mm. The top 60 from the sprint results start the pursuit, and they go at at the time intervals according to the sprint finish results. Mm. But there's only 30 lanes. So if you've got a really tight sprint result, you'll get more than 30 athletes come in to the shooting range needing a mat and a place to go. And so those ones who are standing there waiting and twiddling their thumbs, that time gets measured and subtracted from their time at the end of the race. But it's a bit like you said there, Ross, you don't know that until the end of the race. But usually that's the worst athletes, because it's the ones that weren't in the top 30. Yeah. So it's usually not a big deal.
Do the elite athletes know who's had 1 minute penalties? Because I'd hate to be that person skiing with my competitor thinking they've had a 2 minute penalty and I'm only on one, but actually I got it wrong. They're on one and so am I. And you don't actually understand who's winning the race yourself.
They're pretty good. They don't have radios like you would in cycling, but they get a lot of feedback out on the course.
Okay.
So you'll see, if you watch the races, you'll see that all the coaches are congregated on a sort of hill climb section where the athletes are obviously going a lot slower and can take on board more information. And you'll see all the coaches running, sprinting side by side along their athletes, shouting either just hey, 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 up, 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 like speed up stuff, encouragement, it could be information about how much time they've got, how much ahead they are, even though it feels like more or less, for example.
Yeah.
So they do get a lot of, they're really good at that, I would say. The coaches are on it, everyone's on it. They also get feedback information about how they've shot on the targets, for example. So there's lots of interaction, I would say, to information to the athletes out on the course.
When I watch biathlon, it always fascinates me to think about the intersection between the technical skill of shooting and the physiological challenge of being out of breath and in a state exactly the opposite to what you want to be when you shoot. So I've always wanted to ask someone, Are they much better shooters than in a race situation, or are they so well trained and accustomed to it that their shooting ability is relatively unaffected by the physiology and of actually skiing?
Yeah, it is affected, but it will be a lot less affected than a beginner or a less elite or like a developmental athlete. So it is affected, but they are able to minimize it, that's for sure. And I was also talking about this to my PhD student a little bit yesterday, and because I didn't know of any study, and we don't think that there are any studies that have actually measured that under sort of controlled conditions, so that I've got actual, you know, data that I could discuss about how good they are in different conditions, because they also train in different conditions. So you've got fully rested, you've got shooting after just low intensity exercise, shooting in a sort of training race environment, and then shooting in an actual race environment. But anecdotally, and what we know just from tons and tons of experience of working with these teams, and some of my research colleagues have been kind of head coach of national teams as well, so we've got a lot of kind of in-house information. They do a lot of kind of training races. So at our stadium where we live, for example, even in the summer on their roller skis. So it'll be the same sort of intensity as a race setup. And in those setups, they're able to shoot, or they shoot pretty much as well on their training races in a training environment as they would in a competition environment at kind of World Cup or Olympics. So what they are able to do is handle the pressure, if you know what I mean, so that the physiological impact is about the same, and then the shooting performance is about the same. But if you shoot at rest, you will shoot better, because the body can basically be more still, because you don't have high ventilation rates, you don't have the lungs moving around. The heart itself, just the pump, you know, the beating of the heart is quite a large vibration for these athletes with massive stroke volumes and cardiac outputs. So that they need to get into control. So they hold their breath while they shoot, so that ventilation, but they've still got their heart is still beating. There are studies on how much the heart rate drops as they come into the range and shoot.
Some of those, amazingly, down to 60-70%.
They get it low, very quickly. And they slow down. So it's very tactical, and it's a big part of their kind of experience as well, is how slow can they afford to ski for those kind of that amount of distance coming into the shooting range. How slow can they afford to ski before they've come onto the mat itself in order to prepare all of that physiological stuff? And all different ranges and stadiums have got different types of entries into the shooting arena, into the range, if you know what I mean. So some is easier to kind of like glide into and be quite flat. Others, you've got to keep on working quite hard before entering the range. So yeah, there's lots of small factors to think about there.
I did read one study where they compared the very best to the level below. So let's say elite versus sub-elite. And the thing that was interesting was that the shooting accuracy was quite similar between the groups, but the speed with which the elite athletes got their shots off is much quicker. So they spend less time achieving the same accuracy, which I took to interpret as they're all quite good at knowing when they can shoot. They're quite good at understanding when exactly is the best time to pull the trigger, but that the elite athletes just get to that state of accuracy quicker than the sub-elite. Would that interpretation be well off or no?
There might be studies showing that. I don't know which one that is specifically you're talking about. There's four that I think about quite a lot. There was a PhD done over in Trondheim in Norway with one of the guys who now works with the Norwegian Biathlon Federation. And there's one that we've done out of our center that's just been published. So all of these are the last few years. And actually those studies show slightly different, that they're all top level. So I don't know how high your elite and sub-elite were. I would imagine the bigger the gap between the athletes, then definitely the timing is more of a factor. But in these four studies, so Harry Luchsinger is the lead author on three of them, and Glenn Bjorklund with us is lead author on the other one. All of those show actually that shooting accuracy and skiing speed are about equivalently equal, and that they're clearly the most important factors. So the accuracy still is the most important factor, together with skiing speed, over timing itself, because it's so expensive. It's so much more expensive than taking a few more seconds to shoot than to miss a shot.
Sure.
But definitely shooting speed is like one of the two components of shooting performance. It comes down to the shooting speed and the shooting accuracy. Mm. But the accuracy in terms of overall performance is going to be more important.
You mentioned, but you're right. You mentioned just a few moments ago how they get that heart rate down. What techniques do they use to do that when they're getting into the shooting space?
I mean, they slow down like prior to coming in. So it's a little bit, like I said, it's like how hard can they afford to go or not go throughout the whole ski loops? So it's really difficult to know how they have to control. So you might see like a lot of athletes will ski a lot faster on that final loop when they've got no more shooting to do than you've seen them ski on all the other four loops prior to that, because they've done that in order to offset, you know, it's a balance. How slow can I afford to ski in order to keep my personal heart rate below, like as relatively low as I can? So the better skier you are, the slower you can afford to ski, because relatively you're going to be at a lower percent heart rate than everybody else around you, kind of thing. So that's one thing. It's just making your skiing better so that you can be at a relatively lower heart rate to stay with the pack. And then it's like, yeah, slowing it down as they come in. And then they just have to, like, as soon as they're on the mat, I mean, it's just a training response. There's no special tricks. They don't have any special tricks to like get their heart rate lower than anybody else.
They don't sort of hyperventilate beforehand so that they can hold their breath for longer or anything like that.
No. And I mean, that would like affect their heart as well. So they do hold their breath while they shoot, and some of them will hold their breath constantly throughout the shots, but some can't kind of necessarily manage that. I think that's quite uncommon. But I guess it's just a training response, really. I don't have any good sort of like scientific answer to that, really.
Yeah. The problem is, I mean, you could get yourself into a calm state with breathing, but they're already hyperventilating just to ski. So that's the challenge, is they're so far off homeostasis and balance when they come in there that it's, so the key is, I guess, you just got to change your ceiling so that you can be further from it.
And when you say it's a training response, I mean, do they train that ability to be able to stop and get their heart rate down? Like, in other words, do they concentrate on their breathing and they're getting their heart rate down in training sessions?
Yeah. And they'll shoot, you know, I mentioned some training races before. They will, I think, because we've got a paper with a PhD student I've mentioned, and one of my other colleagues, they've got a paper kind of that's analyzed the physical training, so the ski training and also the shooting training of the Swedish biathletes who won medals at Pyeongchang, for example, at the Olympic Games. So that's quite a nice paper with just a simple table that talks about the shooting training. And about 10%, so they take about 22,000 shots per year. So it's just a nice table to summarize to get an idea of what they're doing. And that will be over about 210 sessions. So I'm just like reading from the paper now. So that's about 100 shots per session. And they'll train almost 2 out of every 3 days shooting. So it's a lot of shots. And about 10% of that, so 2,400 shots training under stress. So that'll be this kind of thing that we're talking about. It'll be coming into the range at a very high load, high intensity, and then working on their breathing and their heart rate and their muscular like stability. And that's also a big one, obviously, when they're fatigued, is that it's very difficult to stand still when your muscles are not wanting to hold you still. And then about 10% of their shots will just be for precision, where it'll be kind of at rest. They also do a lot of dry shooting. So it can be in a hotel room or at home or whatever. They'll stick up kind of like targets and do dry shooting. So there's a hell of a lot of shots taken, and they take them in different scenarios: at rest, totally dry shooting, and then just in a normal training session. So it might be that they're like, it's a bit more of a lower intensity session, and then these very high intensity training race type sessions. And they do that quite a lot. And this is, I'm just talking our Swedish team, because that's all I've got a great deal of information about.
Yeah, fascinating stuff.
But we are good, yeah.
Well, Kerry, thank you very much for your time. It's been absolutely fantastic talking to you about this, because I think the exponential growth of my knowledge in the last 45 minutes has been amazing. So I'm certainly going to watch the Winter Olympics with a lot more knowledge, and just understanding some of that physiology is, yeah, remarkable. They're very unique for us here in South Africa, because we have no experience of these type of athletes here, and you know, it is a particular set of skills that they have.
Yeah, steep learning curves. So yeah. that was great though. Really, really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much, Kerry.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.